Blog Talk Radio.
Talk about some things Masonic, of course, and see what else we can come up with. Should be great fun, and I'm looking forward to it. Do you think that we can get into a little bit? I want to wrap up some of the history that I've started a little earlier, and confess that we've had more than a few computer complications at this end that have just messed up the karma far more than I care to admit. Anyway, all of that aside, the hospitality at Thistle Lodge the last weekend was incredible. And if I'd like to suggest that if any of you happen to be in Amherstburg, Ontario, you might want to look up those fellows. The lodge room has some very interesting paintings, relics of the bygone days that are hard to describe. The Freemasonry on the Frontier was a great success, celebrating the time of the conditions around the War of 1812, the relationships and harmony that really predated the existence of Canada, and in some ways the existence of the United States as we know it today. Masons were there carrying on Masonic activity before our border was really quite firm. The historians in the place, particularly a fellow named Alexander Dale, was exceptional. Just could sit and listen to this fellow for hours and hours. But I'm sure that the rest of you have been up to all kinds of activities too. We've started to get into the fall season here. And we have a lot to preserve. I have been thinking more about the sense of expansion and the worry that we've had over the, past number of years about shrinkage. And I'm going to try and draw your attention away from that a bit and replace it with a notion that that our work now is no longer expansion. We know how to do that. And with expansion, you know, eventually tides go in and tides go out. So it's a considerable amount of energy that we're talking about. So I try to look at it organically, that this isn't something negative at all. This is exactly what it's intended to be. It's the pulse. It's the rate of change. And I would hope that that you share that confidence that we are moving forward. But the work is different today. No longer are we needing to focus on on the expansion. But I think what we're experiencing in the 21st century, and yes, I'm one of those that looks at these types of events as a turning point, whether it is or not, whether it's just the mechanics of my imagination. But I think that we're getting into a period of evolution. The craft is evolving, as it always has, but significantly. The first portion, I would say, is a product of the Renaissance and the Reformation. Others would argue that it might be a sense of the stabilization in the politics, or like I like to think, the craft was dependent on the quirkiness of the time in three very significant countries in the landmass we know as Britain today, Britain and Ireland, and Scotland. That said, idea, thought has not come to an end, did not come to an end. You and I could say that we're products of, if we're good students, we're products of a more classical education than a lot of people today have been exposed to, except in perhaps around university and college campuses. And then ours is esoteric. It's very unique. It's unusual. But I hope that you will you'll become curious about history. And it's not just, I think it would be a mistake, a tragedy, to limit yourself to this notion that there's a Masonic history and then there's a world history. When did we get that? When did we ever declare that disconnect? Absolutely not. Ours is a philosophy of application, that of the demonstration, or if you will, the proof of change. That little blurb that you heard was my daughter wishing me a happy birthday. So happy birthday to me. And I'm glad that you've all joined me today to help me celebrate this inauspicious occasion. And to all of you, I know that there are always people more clever than me, and perhaps in some ways I may have something to contribute that another fellow may not. But we're drifting through the cosmos together, learning as we go along. Keep your mind open to the ideas and the values that have changed and the way that they've changed. And if you think that a change occurs without struggle, I think, I guess in some way, pacifist in us all would like to think that's the case, but the realist amongst us would say, the stoic amongst us would say, you know, that's a bit of a dream. The reality is people struggle, they cling to what they know, right or wrong. Only hindsight determines the rightness or wrongness of the thought or actions. And in the meantime, day by day, we try to do the best we can, make decisions based on the information that we have at hand, without having the ability of hindsight. Oh, that we did. Perhaps the best advantage that we have then is to be careful historians. And I say careful because it's important to not just pick out the bits of history stroke our own egos. That's, if you think about it in this context, a bit childish. Although it feels wonderful to always be looked at as if you're quite clever and always right. In fact, come on, really? That's what you've got? That's what you think? We all have opinions, perspectives that occur unique to the person behind those eyes. But there are, I guess, I would think, some ultimate truths out there. And even that is regulated or influenced by the laws of probability. You know, if you said today the boiling point of water is what it is, you know, somebody very clever is going to find another way of measuring with some degree of accuracy that we can all agree on. And perhaps that point will change. So just when I get set and hear me myself thinking something as stupid as this is the way it always has been, this is the way it always will be, I know darn well that I'm putting my foot in my mouth. So history teaches us things like that. Remember, Margaret McMillan, she's, you know, the great historian and Canadian. Thank you very much. A little flag waving for Canada. It reminds us that we have to be looking at history from both sides, like the Simon and Garfunkel song. Look at it from both sides now. That's the way we understand candidly the and objectively the lessons that times past can teach us. And so I would ask you, have we been a good stewards of that approach? I can't say that I have. I try and struggle for objective and accurate information. And it's important because I like to have maybe a good friend pointed out the BBC style of doing things. You know, they want to give you the unvarnished fact and let you draw your own conclusions. Now, that said, we like to think that there are some sources of information that are and declare and pride themselves on being more objective than others. The Guardian, New York Times, perhaps, Washington Post, BBC, although, you know, you can shoot holes through that argument with the national broadcaster, of course. Al Jazeera right now, Al Jazeera News is remarkable. Of course, they went and hired, they went and hired a great deal, great many talented people to sit and put some serious money behind it. And my goodness, these aren't people that were prone to selling their reputations. Am I straying too far then to be reminded that there is a concern in the Arab nations? Once the source or legitimately or argumentatively one could say a source of great knowledge, sciences and arts, and a source of, and a place of tolerance. So before we sharpen our whatevers and grab our whatevers and arm ourselves up, you know, I've been thinking that it's not a peoples or a geography that causes us grief. It's zealots. The history of that part of the world was enormously tolerant. Or I guess I would say history reminds us that it was as tolerant as any other place. And even the definition of tolerance has changed. Is waterboarding exactly an example that we've progressed? Now, yeah, let the testosterone drip out our ears with that one. There's lots of examples. The stain, you know, use of atomic weapons, probably for me a great stain on the conscience of mankind. But before that, there were known for massacre. I think massacre doesn't come out of a sense of, you know, bloodlust. I think it comes primarily from a primary or primal sense of fear. What do we fear so much that we have to kill it? Ideas, usually, I think. If it wasn't enough to make you weep, you'd almost laugh. The zealots of any faith don't represent any one great nation. They are what they are. They're fringe. Loud, obnoxious, but fringe. I understand the Haredi in Israel are are the source of a great deal of discussion. A gentle peoples who want to study and have negotiated a buy from conscription, but but they've grown in such numbers that there's concern now from Israeli economists that it could, they don't, it's raising questions about how the nation can support this growing group of people. And every great nation, every great faith-based group has inherits, I think, the notion of zealots. Your zealots come at our, going to attack our zealots going to attack your zealots, leaves us all, leaves us, the people that are searching for that common faith that we can all agree upon. And I declare that that's the majority of people in the face of the earth. It leaves us in a state of agitation, upheaval, uncertainty. Then it's just not right. And for me to conjure up any sense that, to justify, wipe away any sense of reason because the zealots are carrying on like they always do. They're mayhem. They're waiting to be disciplined or supervised by clearer thinkers. I think we can do better than that. The 21st century, I think Freemasonry is probably a threat to the zealots of the world, if I can say that. Unintentional. If openness is a threat, then we would be, I think, guilty of that. Do you think we are? Do you think we're open? Do you think we're receptive? I do. Oh, there's usually somebody that, you know, the guys that will make fun of, talk about, mock us, continue to mock us from the some of the writings that were used to fearmonger, you know, books that were put out that were blasphemous, caused fearmongering among about Freemasons. There's still some of us in some of us within the order that will feel glee, you know, thoughtlessly bring it up, especially around when we're welcoming a new initiate. And I, it always puzzles me, sort of, like, why would we continue the mockery that has was designed to shame us? Why would any one of us ever mention that? But, you know, maybe those brethren that do that are serving a purpose. They're there to remind us that that thoughtful men need to be, you know, aware, alert, not paranoid. There's something to be learned, I believe, from zealots. Doesn't mean they're necessarily unintelligent. You know, it doesn't. But it's always interesting when somebody gives me anecdotal proof because I went through it. Therefore, you know, that group of people that declare that their experience gives them a unique insight into the process of humanity. I wish it were so. I wish it were so. We'd be a much different nation today if that were the case. So what do you do? Let me regale you, not in the literal sense of the term, but let me talk to you a bit about, let me finish up with that material I was talking to you about the short history of the craft. Remember, sorry, this is the 4th of October, 2012. On this day, Pope Innocent was crowned the German King Otto of Wittelsbach. Of course, you would remember that from 1209. And this is in 1282, the last Julian calendar day in Spain, Portugal, pontifical states. This is the last day. And that was in, it was a while ago. This was in 1636. On this date, there was the first code of law by the Plymouth colony. And now they were an interesting bunch. Zealots who, we could say, compared to why they left, their sense of persecution, they're an odd bunch. And they made their way over to an area where they felt they wouldn't, they would be able to put their feet down and live comfortably, not be challenged. And then that was in 1636. In 1648, Peter Stuyvesant establishes America's first volunteer fireman. And didn't he also roll a cigarette? Wasn't Stuyvesant a type of cigarette? And on this date in 1675, Christian Huygens patents the pocket watch. That's how far back that goes. There's a King Henry III of Castile was born in 1379 on this date. And on this date, there was some, I guess you could say, is death ever famous? In 1669, Rembrandt, the Dutch painter, died. He was only 63. Gee, he'd be living a better life than Rembrandt. The emperor in 1305, Kamiyama of Japan died on this date. Anyway, it's a remarkable day, and if I forget, remind me to remind yourself to continue to commit random acts of Masonic kindness. I like to think that's where we actually extend understanding, where some yob would think that we can have the right to be intolerant instead of letting our words run away with us if we embrace one of the Masonic mottos. I'm particularly struck with the Aude, the first word of our motto. Listen. So when somebody's saying something, whether we agree with it or not, if we stop instead of opening our getting into a rebuttal of every thought that we don't agree with, which is kind of remarkable when you think about it. Listen. The true Mason has that ability, I think. True in the sense that the understanding Mason is the true Mason. The rest of us are dress up and do what we do. Let me get into this a little bit. We want to talk, I want to recover this notion of accepted Masons. I'll feel confident talking to you about this in open air because it is accessible to the entire planet or anybody with the ability to get to the internet, and with the efforts being made internationally to put computers and wireless systems in remote areas, then hopefully one day everybody will have that same access. Let's see what we can do with it. Huh? If you don't mind, I'll talk about accepted Masons. There, and this is from that material from 1963, a little bit obscure. It's a paper delivered at the 8th Biennial Conference of Canadian Grand and District Grand Lodges, Winnipeg, Manitoba, the 16th of February, 1963. That's before Kennedy was shot, I think. Sad day for North America. There is positive evidence that when accepted masonry existed in London and was active before it, that accepted masonry existed in London was active before the end of the 17th century. There is also evidence of other lodges of accepted Masons in England at the time. We have the entry in the diary of Elias Ashmole that he was made a Mason at Warrington in 1646. That's probably when some of you were learning to tie your shoes out there. So you'll be able to recount this day with some accuracy. And the statement of Randall Holm that he was made a Mason at Chester, probably in the 1670s. From these records, it would be correct to say that these two men, and doubtless many others, were made Masons, not in an operative lodge, but in a group of accepted Masons. Among them may have been some operatives, but such lodges, whether merely occasional or a semi-permanent nature had no connection with the operative craft. The only known operative lodges in England outside of London were in Alnwick, whose minutes show that it was in existence in 1701, and at Swalwell, an unattached lodge of which the first authentic records date from 1725, though it was evidently in existence before that date. As these lodges were not far from the Scottish border, we are led to conclude that there was a Scottish influence in their practices. No non-operatives or gentlemen masons were associated with these lodges before 1730. Now remember, this is a time before there was, we're talking about a time where constitution was, when was that sort of ratified? You know, let me use that word, 1723. And then, was that widely spread? And ask yourself, was the ritual consistent? No, it came later. Was the recounting and recording of minutes a requirement? No. And I don't, to be really candid and not to be unkind, I don't think it's really progressed very far today. You know, people do the bare basics in the minutes and really don't express anything of the character of the meeting, the character of the lodge. It's sort of as remote and detached as one could possibly record. Those minutes are documents for the future masons 100 years from now, to be able to convey to them what life was like and what masonry was like and what was important to us today. And I fear, as I, you know, if you've ever had the pleasure of looking through minutes, it's really spotty. Some of them are exceptional, but they seem to be, unfortunately, the rarity. Most of them are fairly routine, Clark-like, as if we've generated a whole process of bureaucrats that just want to go through the motions in a detached way. Surely the order can draw better from us and deserves better. The development of masonry in Scotland followed an entirely different pattern than from that in England. There, the trade was much more closely knit, and we have clear evidence of an organized craft with a great deal of cooperation and collaboration in different parts of Scotland. This collaboration centers mostly in the King's Master of the Works, who, along with the masters of the head lodges, constituted the central authority controlling the various local lodges. The statutes drawn up in 1598 and 1599 by William Skaw, then King's Master of the Works, set out the duties and responsibilities of the workmen. They used the word lodge, referring to a body of masons controlling the building activity in a particular town. These will be distinguished from a group of operatives meeting in a lodge or a workshop attached to a building site. The lodges controlling the trade in a town were under the supervision of head lodges, such as those in Kilwinning, Edinburgh, and Glasgow. Such masons' trade bodies authorized the admission of apprentices. First, these apprentices were booked. Sort of like, it reminds me of, I think they used that term at a union hall when I was a boy. I was part of a union. I think you were booked. Booked by the municipal authorities. And later they were, quote, entered in the lodge and thus became part of the local lodge organization. So entered distinguished me or you from a booked apprentice. Yep. At the end of their term of training, these entered apprentices, if found worthy, so you had to do a bit of a test or proof, of course, were made fellows of craft. So we can see the entered apprentice and fellow craft. And we also see the accepted, evidence of other lodges of accepted masons. So you were brought in by a group of accepted masons, not operatives. So again, the distinction. When you hear it accepted, you know that we're talking about not operative, not the people in the guilds or doing that kind of work with stone. they were called craft, fellows of the craft. There is, of course, much uncertainty about the details of these customs and how these lodges operated in different counties. The one fact that emerges is the close organization of the Masons' craft in Scotland. Working through reorganized operative lodges, a condition which is not definitely known in England except in London. Records dating from the year 1634 and throughout the century that followed show that in Scotland many non-operatives, men who were not actual Masons, were admitted members of operative lodges. Mostly these were of the nobility or gentry and were referred to as gentlemen Masons. They were, in effect, honorary members, though they paid a fee for admission. And that fee would be higher than that paid by an operative member admitted to the lodge. How much the increasing number of non-operatives or gentlemen Masons contribute to the changing character of the lodges from purely operative to accepted Masonry is not known. It is generally thought that the change came about through changing social conditions rather than by the influence of the non-operatives. In England, the existence of organized operative lodges outside the London Masons Company is purely problematical. Operative lodges in Alnwick and the Swalwell in the beginning of the 18th century were, as has been pointed out, undoubtedly influenced by Scottish practice. The speculative craft was a development of the 18th century, 1700s. It is not possible to give a satisfactory account of the growth of our Masonic ceremonies. The earliest suggestion of ceremony comes from the old charges, which contained an invocation, the legendary history of the craft, and the regulations. We can only say that probably following guild practice, the reading of a version of the manuscript constitutions to the apprentice and the swearing by him to observe the regulations or charges constitutes the whole ceremony of admission among English operative Masons in the Middle Ages. In Scotland, such lodges were essentially operative. There were certain ceremonies in entering the apprentice as a member of the lodge some time after he had been booked in the municipal records. The only information on these ceremonies comes from several catechisms of the late 17th and early 18th centuries. These show that there was an esoteric content of some kind which was communicated to the new member and which was centered around the Mason word. He had to take an oath of secrecy, and then the word was communicated to him accompanied by certain signs. There are suggestions of some crude horseplay in the ceremony. When the entered apprentice was admitted a fellow of the craft or master, another oath of secrecy was required. He learned the posture and signs of fellowship. That is, the points of fellowship. And was given the word, sign, and grip by the master. Thus, two distinct ceremonies were issued. We do not know what the Mason word was or how it originated. The earliest known reference to it is in the diary of the Earl of Rothes in 1637, in which he states that he has the Mason word. The earliest description of the ceremonies connected with the giving of the word is found in the Edinburgh Register House manuscript of 1696. The main purpose of the Mason word was to enable the Mason to prove that he had been regularly admitted into the craft. It was, if we may oversimplify it, what we might call his union card, which would distinguish him from a Cowan, or which who had not been regularly made a member of the organized craft. The Mason word is purely Scottish in its origin and use. It was not known in England until sometime in the 1600s, just as the manuscript, the constitutions, which were English, did not reach Scotland until about the same time. The Mason word, I think, would be more than a union card. It would be the fellow's warrant of a job, without a job, his family, and he would go hungry, or his children would die or starve. You can see the loose tongues that exist around us today that make casual flavor of our secrets, the multiple exposés that we find on the internet, may not have existed in the day when men's lives were extended and their comforts were better, were enhanced because they kept that secret. There was a different need then. Hmm? It should be emphasized again that Scottish Masonry until the end of the 17th century and even later was a trade organization. Its only esoteric content was a secret mode of recognition already referred to. In England, the slender tie and the operative craft had in most cases long been broken by the beginning of the 18th century. Why men gathered in groups to enjoy fellowship under the name of Masonry, we do not know. Something was there which appealed to them, and this was the foundation for the latter growth of the speculative craft. Now you and I can reflect on that. What the authors are saying to us is that same notion, why, isn't really clear. So you and I can think about why it has appealed to us. And perhaps we have that link with the ancient boys. The story of the emergence of speculative from accepted masonry is one that cannot at present anyway be fully told. There was the exception of the London Masons Company of the 17th century and probably earlier. There were the lodges occasional or in a few places possibly meeting with some regularity in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. And finally, there were the four old lodges in London and Westminster, which formed the first Grand Lodge in 1717, purely in their own interests. Remember, this is a time when these fancy buildings and permanent rooms that you and I have come to take for granted didn't exist. If push comes to shove, our lodges will exist. A lodge will exist whether we have a building or a lodge room that we can argue over. Sometime I shake my head and wonder why we bother. Why we bother? Is it our own sense of influence? We really crave that as much? Could we much more obscurely rent a very, very large suite and have it catered and bring our charter, bring the few bits that we need to open a lodge, do our work, do our business, have our banquet and go away. Soften the footprint on the face of the earth. Now, maybe some of you neocon masons see the appeal in that. Having the entered apprentice or having the outer guard actually standing guard, standing watch over us. The other day when we were out on Bob Low Island off the shore of Amherstburg, the lodge opened and it was tiled. But it was tiled in such a unique way with a whistle. And from some distance away, the outer guard responded. He was keeping watch, so nobody could walk near the site. So the communication was out of hail, and it was done with a ship's whistle. Fascinating. All old school. So remember this start in 1717, if we're thinking that this was something that had this magnanimous sense of future, the authors here are saying it was in their own interests. And if you look at the details of that period and that event, one lodge, more than the other three, and I'll let you discover which one it is if it's important to you, one lodge had more of a vested interest in bringing the four together. The representation of the other three was very, very light. Nobody bothers to think that we should
do a head count, how many members were in those lodges and how many showed up. Well, when you look around today, we hear the lament that this lodge has, you know, a large number of people, but few show up. Well, that's our nature. I put it to you that it always was and always will be. And that when we see these enthusiastic, heavily attended, heavily subscribed lodges, that it's more than the order that makes that happen, that allows that to happen. That's chemistry. That's personalities that like and enjoy and have the energy and enthusiasm and appetite to be together. That's where old boys put their shoulder to the wheel and encourage the young boys to take over. A lot of time, too often, I see, and I can I say this to you in all modesty? Sometimes I see old boys acting like everything else should be filtered through their version of their experience of the order. How bleak. How bleak. I had thought, it confuses me, because I had thought the mentor realizes that he doesn't force feed his students, that he waits, and the finest Masonic mentors do this. And if you're ever thinking that you'd like to be that, it's not being self-serving or a giant among men or an intellectual or spouting information. It's waiting until the student asks, watching for that window of curiosity to open before it slams shut under pressure. When the man is receptive to information, where the true mentor stimulates the answers and helps the student, helps his charge to find his own path to answers. That is a true mentor. Not somebody that's following the script, I'm afraid, or somebody that's lauding his opinion over his charges. Far from it. There's a distinct difference. If you're the type that needs to be told and you don't mind having somebody else do your thinking for you, well, that seems to be in abundance in our day-to-day lives. And you can probably scratch the surface and find somebody willing to do that for you in a Masonic context. It's not necessary. This is where our minds begin to broaden. So when you see somebody, you know, trying to exact an opinion from you by imposing his, don't have to get resentful about it. But just watch. That kind of behavior, if you see oily behavior or something that's a bit woolly or dodgy, that tells you more about the people you're with. You don't have to panic. We're not children. Oh, yes, the truth is we can absolutely endorse it. The idea of innovation without fearing that our traditions are going to be affected. Only if in your mind you can't handle both notions at the same time, then of course you'll run around throwing your hands in the air. Reasonable men need to understand and understand the options available to us. If we're going to move forward, it needs to be in a reasonable and thoughtful way, and that means through discussion, back and forth, looking at all the options from all sides. And it's important that you and I feel confident to be participating. And if we don't see that being offered to us, then it's up to us to consider the opportunity that we have to begin that dialogue. Why we continue to chase people, I don't know. And if that's happened to you, if you felt chased or hectored, I don't know if it's... I would like to be able to say I want to apologize for that, but that wouldn't do you any good. I just, like you, I just don't get it. Why anybody would chase a grown man? It fits in the same category as why in the hell would anybody try to guilt you into doing, or me, into doing something? Lecturing me about an obligation, not an obligation that I've taken over over the volume. Let's say instead of obligation, a duty or an expectation or a project. Usually trying to play on my guilt isn't what is what I call inspiring or motivating. Nope, never was. Well, maybe not after the eighth grade. Maybe it was my eighth year. Doesn't work. Reason. But oh my goodness, am I stumbling over questions of leadership? Excuse me. The formation of Grand Lodge has frequently been referred to as a revival. Anderson, speaking at the first meeting of the four lodges, states they constituted themselves a Grand Lodge pre-tempore in due form and forthwith revived the quarterly communication of the officers of lodges called the Grand Lodge, resolved to hold the annual assembly and feast. There is, of course, no evidence that a quarterly communication had ever been held. Turn of a phrase. There is, of course, no evidence that a quarterly communication had ever been held, but there it was. The formation of Grand Lodge was a new development, no doubt a natural outgrowth of Masonic fellowship among the members of the four original lodges. There was no intention on the part of the new organization of controlling the craft outside London and Westminster, nor could it have the faintest idea of the significance of this action for Freemasonry in England and beyond its shores. I don't think we're saying that it was all luck. As for the growth of our craft ritual, again, we have little definite information. With few exceptions, Masonic historians agree that there were two steps or degrees in 1717. There are some hints of a third degree before that time, particularly in the Trinity House Dublin manuscript of 1711. However, all we know with certainty is that by 1730, the Master Mason degree with its legend of Hiram Abiff was known and used in some lodges. Pritchard's Masonry Dissected is an early exposure containing the first printed reference to this degree. It was many years before the Master Mason degree was generally accepted. Up until the middle of the 18th century, brethren largely regarded the Hiramic degree as one which they could take at their leisure, since the Fellowgraph degree qualified them for any office in the Lodge or in Grand Lodge. Now, I'd love to be able to talk to you about certain ritual that occurs in the Fellowgraph degree and the significance of that, but I don't think that's something that I would feel comfortable doing on an open line. But think about at the end of the year, the ritual that occurs, and how the major portion of that occurs in the Fellowcraft, and then link it to this process here. Let it be remembered that even after this third degree was established, Freemasonry had practically nothing of symbolism, nor was it a peculiar system of morality as we understand it. The symbolism and moral teachings which characterize our present-day ritual was a slow growth of the 1700s. During these days, our ritual was gradually taking shape, evolving. Again, there could be no uniformity of growth. Different ideas developed with their own particular way of working, and some would progress more rapidly than others. We have a custodian of the work. If you and I see something that we think needs tweaking, we can put the question to him for his study and deliberation and consultation. The work changes, and bits of work, as we've seen, changes. Like the last bit was the rubric. Wonderful. But it has always evolved, and hopefully that's a living tool that we need. The authority of Grand Lodge in its early years was limited. At first, it was local, but as its influence widened, it had to deal with the unwillingness of some lodges to submit to its rule. And with the practice of making Masons outside the regulations of Grand Lodge. The remainder of the 18th century brought progress amid many difficulties. Of its course, like that of true love, did not run smooth. There were many developments in the century following 1717, which it is not possible to discuss here in any detail. The greatest challenge to the original Grand Lodge came from the movement which resulted in the formation of a rival Grand Lodge in 1751. This new group, commonly referred to as the Ancients, was not a succession from the older organization, which was to become known as the Moderns. It was a separate movement mainly instigated by brethren from Ireland as a protest against the social advantages of the original body and against certain changes which, it was claimed, had been made by them in the old customs. The division, at times acrimonious and bitter, ended in 1813 with the union of the two Grand Lodges to form the United Grand Lodge of England. There were other disturbances during this period which marred the harmony of the craft. An old lodge in the city of York, whose records dated back to 1705 and which was most likely in existence before that time, set itself up in the year 1725 as the Grand Lodge of all England. It never had much influence, and after a precarious existence faded out about 1792. Take a look at the history of Masonry in York. There's something about 200 years and York and Masonry that you might find very revealing. There was also formed in London in 1779 the Grand Lodge of England south of the River Trent. This arose out of a dispute between the Grand Lodge and the Time Immemorial Lodge of Antiquity, in which the famous William Preston was the leading spirit. It had a brief existence of about 10 years, in which it constituted two lodges in London. Long before this time, Masonry had spread widely over the British Isles, over to the continent and across to Europe and other parts of the world. Oh dear. By 1725, the Grand Lodge of Ireland had been formed, and the Grand Lodge of Scotland was established in 1736. Slow off the mark, far from it. You want to think that the question would be why? Why form a Grand Lodge? If you want a man to do anything, it's important that he understand why. What's his motivation? What's the reasoning? Before, so that he can come to the same conclusion that you have, that there's some merit in the idea. So why form a Grand Lodge? I'm in the Highlands, and I meet, and we meet, and we do quite well, thank you very much. A pushover? These things take time. The final development of Freemasonry into a stable organization with well-developed customs, regulations, and ceremonies came with the union of the Moderns and the Ancients in 1813. In the preceding century, the ritual was taking shape. Countless brethren, unknown to us, made their contributions to it. Some, like William Preston and Dr. Samuel Hemming, left an indelible imprint upon it. The symbolism of Freemasonry grew, and its teachings and principles were clarified. Through the Lodge of Reconciliation, representing both Grand Lodges, and which carry on its work between 1813 and 1816, the content of the craft ceremonies and ritual was decided. as this lodge or reconciliation was not allowed to keep any written records, we cannot now for sure be sure that we know in exact detail the results of their work. Now, I often thought about that when Anderson and DeSalier were charged, when Anderson was charged with creating a constitution. He began working with a fellow by the last name of DeSalier. He was a fellow that came from France during the Huguenot expulsion. He was also a minister, a clergyman like Anderson. But can you imagine, they collected all this manuscripts, bits of information together and in different dialects. And they were charged with the task of forming a constitution. And I think they did one remarkable job. But these fellows were absolutely brilliant. And the thinkers at the time were quite clever. Me today, I would like to know what they left on the floor. What was almost good enough? Were there two ideas that had merit and you sort of tossed a coin? I don't know that. But by destroying all of the records that remained after they had made their decisions, you and I are spared the vitriol or second guessing. Those ideas, surely, that were on the floor are available somewhere. But you and I were left with a clean copy. I think that's brilliant. It's like the same brilliance that asks us, invites us in Lodge, not to talk about politics or religion. These are things that make bright men appear completely stupid. So thank goodness we don't. Ah, dear. Through the Lodge of Reconciliation, representing both Grand Lodges, the ancients and the moderns, the content of the craft ceremonies and rituals was decided. At this Lodge of Reconciliation, As this Lodge of Reconciliation was not allowed to keep any written records, we cannot now be sure that we know in exact detail the results of their work. There were and are, of course, wide differences in the way this content is presented. But the basic ritual which each of us knows, the organization of Grand Lodge, and the fundamental principles which guide us were finally determined and definitely established scarcely 150, this would be now 200 years ago. Here, then, in barest outline is an attempt to trace the growth of the craft of ours through its operative, accepted, and speculative stages. Preparing such an outline might almost be compared to the task of an archaeologist who attempts to reconstruct the civilization of an ancient people from a collection of artifacts. Yet, it is desirable that we make an effort to know the background of Masonry. Only by encouraging our members to seek to a fuller knowledge of our loved fraternity will we be able to displace the imaginative theories and narratives that too often pass for Masonic history. Freemasonry regards truth as one of its fundamentals, and so any member will be the better Freemason for having tried to find, as far as can be discovered, the provable facts of this, our Masonic craft. I hope that's given you something to think about. It wasn't that long ago. Do we look around at each other and realize that we're part of something that did evolve and continues to evolve? We are of ideas. We are of principles. But we are of flesh and bone if we do nothing with them but talk about them. As Mark Twain said, get your facts first, and then you can distort them as much as you please. at least get the facts. Then have fun with them. Remember, go after them. Albert Einstein, our friend, said, the important thing is not to stop questioning. Any man who is under 30 and is not a liberal has no heart. And any man who is over 30 and is not a conservative has no brains. Thank you, Winston Churchill. Unbelievable. You know, some of us sometimes stumble into amazing ideas. For whatever reason, you and I stumble through the doors of Freemasonry. So don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened. You know, this is an opportunity to rub shoulders with people who are trying to absorb, like idea sponges. You and I are, the history groupies of the world. If you put us together in a group, who would suspect that we just... Some fellas are into some very, very esoteric material, but as Oscar Wilde said, be yourself. Everyone else is already taken. Be yourself. Be the historian. Develop that aspect that fascinates you. Follow your curiosity. It used to drive me to distraction every time I heard somebody talk about this journey, starting this journey. Well, what would that mean? Sitting in the back seat, no air conditioning, and taking Gravol. And a car with very poor springs, no power brakes, not a bit of padding or seatbelt in the conception of mankind. Good times. So I had to divorce myself from the... And you, some of you fellas are old enough to remember that. Don't give me that. Dad slammed the brake on. Everybody flew from their perch in the rest spot in the back window and hit the back seats of the front passengers. Be the change that you wish to see in the world, my brethren. Be the change. You know you're in love with something when you can't fall asleep because reality is finally better than your dreams. Does that work? Of course it works. Now we're going to be talking about, I think we have shows coming up soon, don't we? And I think we have some interesting shows coming along. I personally think so. And I know we're going to have more time together. So before I cut myself off here, you've had enough, and thank you for being so clever and talking and figuring out how to download this onto your MP3 player and listen to it on the way to work. I think that's just incredible. We've got some shows coming up. We've got a show coming up on the 15th, and I'm going to run that live at 8:30 right now, 8:30 in the evening. And then I've got another one coming up on the 29th of October. The 18th we're going to have From Expansion to Evolution, Changes Changing. And on the 29th, we're going to be talking about We Were Boys Once, and then life became serious and rewarding. So who knows, we may actually stumble over something forever. If you seek validation for preconceived notions, you'll probably find comfort in Freemasonry that comes if you keep very quiet. If you seek truth, you are prepared to toss orthodoxy to the wind and become a changed person. There's risk. The greatest risk takers, I think, aren't you and I. It's the thinkers that formed the ideas that were so radical at the time and influenced the change that allowed science to put aside, step in to replace the notions of fantasy. When we were young, we had expansion in our mind. Preservation meant being large enough to weather the ubiquitous threat of dying. You always stoked up the fire, didn't you? Enough. The absence of an intellectual confidence left us running from shadows. Superstition prevailed. We stepped into the 21st century and out of the timid notion that stability is about volume. Our future, the future of Freemasonry, remains as it always has been, ideas about an ethical life. Today, Freemasons want to know. They need answers. What is the secret word? Well, it looms overhead if you are bright enough to decipher it. Come back. Sit down and join the rest of us. Don't expect to be handed anything but the tools you need to complete the work yourself. But of course, you already know that. We're in interesting times. Fascinating times. I'm going to finish up the program today with just a little blurb. Just a little blurb from Masonic Dictionary, if you don't mind. I hope you don't mind, because I'll do it anyway. I think it's well worth us taking a look at. We're going to... I'll try and get into... I'm just looking here to try and get into something that would be... I think will have appeal to you. How about from a bit on symbolical masonry? Do you mind? Thank you. I'm glad you liked that idea. I'm sitting here surrounded with piles of books. I like to think of this as a version of Cicero's work. A room without books is like a body without a soul. I think that fits here. This is a little bit on accepted. According to Masonic tradition, the Masons are said to have acquired the name Accepted in the building of the Second Temple, for the fraternity were declared free by King Solomon, and the brethren, when the First Temple was completed, were furnished with an honorary jewel or gold medal with the word free inscribed upon it. The posterity of some of the Masons who assisted in the erection of Solomon's temple, having settled on the confines of Judea, were carried into captivity with the Jews, and preserving a knowledge of the sciences of geometry and architecture, even in their fallen fortunes, were liberated by Cyrus and subsequently declared free and accepted. Exonerated from all imposts, duties, and taxes, and invested with the privilege of bearing arms by Darius and Artaxerxes, who commanded the governors of the surrounding provinces that they should require no tax or imposition from any of the priests, Levites, porters, or any that were concerned about the temple, and that no man should have authority to impose anything upon them. That's old school. That's old school. I kind of like that. Buried treasures. We have a tradition that King Solomon concealed certain treasures beneath the foundation of the temple, which were found when they were opened to build the second temple. It was common in ancient times to secrete treasures in such vaults and caverns. I did not know that, but I do now. Here's one a bit on the cardinal points. The cardinal points of the compass have a peculiar signification amongst us, and particularly east, west, and south. The east is the place of light, and there stands the worshipable master, a pillar of wisdom as a representation of the rising sun. And as that luminary opens the glorious day to light mankind to their labors, and so the worshipable master occupies this station to open lodge and to employ and instruct the brethren in masonry. The south is it's an interesting book. The south is a station of another important officer, the pillar of beauty, who is placed in that quarter that he may be prepared to mark the sun at its meridian.
In the west stands the pillar of strength, to mark the setting sun and close the labors of the day by command of the presiding officer. So that, those are the cardinal points, compass points. We may not always think about them. Here's a little mention of the cautious secrecy of the craft in the early ages was used to prevent the great principles of science by which their reputation was secured and maintained from being publicly known. Even the inferior workmen were unacquainted with the secret and refined mechanism which cemented and imparted the treasure of wisdom. They were profoundly ignorant of the wisdom which planned, the beauty which designed, and knew only the strength and labor which executed the work. The doctrine of the pressure and counterpressure of complicated arches was a mystery which they never attempted to penetrate. They were blind instruments in the hands of intelligent master masons and completed the most sublime undertakings by the effect of mere mechanical skill and physical power, without being able to comprehend the secret which produced them, without understanding the nice adjustment of the members of a building to each other, or so necessary to accomplish and permanent effect, or without being able to enter into the science exhibited in the complicated details which were necessary to form harmonious and proportionate detail. That starts to make some sense. I'm going to leave you with just a little, I had a little piece on the Soro Lodges. In this country, this would be Britain, this was from, yes, this is, I'm reading from material by Robert McCoy, you know, rather old. Yeah, this is from, McCoy was around between 1850. Let me come back to that. I am so happy that you've been able to join me today. I hope I've been of some use to you. Now we're topping the thousands of listeners. Yep. I hope you're getting something out of it, and I'll try and make the next show better than this one. We're going to try and get through, I promise you, get through some of the technical difficulties. In the meantime, we have some Thanksgiving to give. I hope you gather with your friends. I hope you find a kindness in your heart. Whether you're walking alone or in the company of thousands, I hope you find that moment of reflection where you can recognize that you are a true embodiment of everything that is Masonic. Don't listen to me. Listen to your heart. As Oscar Wilde said, I am so clever that sometimes I don't understand a single word of what I'm saying. See you soon.
Thank you.